Our high school guidance counselor used to ask us what you would do if you had $1 million, didn't have to work. And then invariably, whatever you'd say, that was supposed to be your career. So if you wanted to fix old cars, then you're supposed to be an auto mechanic.
So what did you say?
I never had an answer. I guess that's why I'm working at Inatec.
No, you're working at Inatec because that question is bullshit to begin with. If everyone listened to her, there'd be no janitors because no one would clean up if they had $1 million.
If I had $1 million...
Talking about millions of dollars.
What would you do if you had $1 million?
I'll tell you what I'd do, man. Two chicks at the same time, man.
We're living in a material world, and I am a material girl. Or boy.
Well, what about you now? What would you do?
Besides two chicks at the same time?
Well, yeah.
Nothing.
Nothing, huh?
I would relax. I would sit on my ass all day. I would do nothing.
Well, you don't need $1 million to do nothing, man. Take a look at my cousin. He's broke, don't do
If I had $1 million.
Hello and welcome back to Snacks and Jacks. I'm Tom Allen, Andrew on the board on this cold Wednesday morning where we're expecting a cold front to make it even colder. Andrew will tell you all about it in that when he does the weather, but it's nasty here and getting nastier. S&P futures down 9, NASDAQ futures down 79, Dow futures down 64. This is after a horrendous day yesterday, as in horrendous. Even if you don't want to hear it, we're going to say it. We were down 870 on the Dow, 143 on the S&P, and 561 on the NASDAQ, which is 2.4%. That's an ouch. We, however, did have a big rally in gold, $100, and silver, a little bit yesterday, up 5 cents. And we had crypto, took it on the chin, $1,300. So it was not the best day if you were long, kind of across the board. A couple spots were up, but not very many. Do we have Professor Kevin?
Good morning. Yes, you do.
How are you?
I'm doing okay. Hey, how would you have answered that question, that million-dollar question in high school?
What million-dollar question?
My high school guidance counselor asked us what we would do if we had $1 million.
Well, back then it was a lot of money.
Oh yeah, and so but the way the quote goes is whatever your answer is, that's supposed to be your career.
Oh wow.
That's the opening clip today.
So yeah, I know. Nobody ever asked me the question, but I guess I would have upgraded my 65 Olds to maybe a 66. Remember the Mike Royko column?
Well, you would have been a used car salesman.
Remember the Mike Royko column about the guys winning the lottery?
What was it?
He said, this is when the lottery first started. And, I mean, it was like what you're talking about, Kevin. It was like $1 million or a couple $1 million. And he said he's so tired of hearing these people say they won like $2 million and they're gonna pay off the 58 Chevy, and if there's any money left, they're gonna take the wife for a weekend and to Stony Island or someplace. He goes, now my friend Phil T. Slob, he won the $2 million last week. He walked into his bar, he bought everybody around, he says, that's the last time I have a drink in a dump like this. Then he told his wife, pack the bags, going around the world. He goes, wait a minute, you're not going. And off he went. I don't think you and I would be that harsh, but...
Speaking of that wife comment, I saw a joke. It goes something like this. A wealthy couple is having dinner in a really nice high-end restaurant. And while they're there, this young babe walks up to the guy, gives him a big long kiss, and says, I'll see you later. And the wife says, what was that? And he says, that's my mistress. And she said, that's it, I've had it, I'm going to file for divorce. And he looked at her and said, think this through before you do. Said, I want you to remember, that's going to mean no more junkets to Paris for shopping, no more spa days, and he goes through this long litany of things that they're not going to be able to do anymore because she's divorced and she's going to be a little more limited in the money she has available. And she sits there and stews about it for a while, and then this other fellow that they know walks in, and he's got a young babe on his arm. And the wife looks and says, who's he with? And she says, that's his mistress. And she thinks for a second, she goes, ours is prettier.
God, ours... there's a few things. I got to get these old books that somehow didn't make it through my mother's flood in the basement. But there's a page in the You remember way back in the day reading the Bonfire of Vanities? It was popular for a while.
Yeah, a long time ago.
Well, I got through about two-thirds of it. Fascinating book. And, of course, my mother, anxious, gives me the ending. So I didn't read the last third type of thing. But there's a page in there. You know, I don't know. This is me saying it. But it's absolutely must-reading for people, I think. Because the guy, when was that book written? 1980 or something, somewhere back there. And the guy was making $1 million a year, like almost exactly. Now, in 1980, $1 million was a lot of shekels, wasn't it? And it was big dough.
Even big money if you were a baseball player.
Yeah, oh yeah.
They weren't making that much. I remember Reggie Jackson getting his first free agent contract for about $800,000 a year, and everybody thought it was nuts. Keep going, though.
Who was the first $1 million guy? Was it David Winfield?
Don't know. That's a good question.
Anyway, so he's at home, and the wife's bitching at him, right, about God knows what. And then he gets in the car, and he's driving to the girlfriend's house. And in his mind, he was a currency trader. So when people would ask him, what do you do for a living? He goes, I buy and sell money. And nobody had any idea what he was talking about, right? Now maybe some people might, but those days, nobody had any idea. I didn't in those days. Well, I guess I did because what I learned at school, but, I mean, the thought of somebody, you know, buying pounds in the morning and selling francs in the afternoon and all this stuff all day long and making money on it, I wouldn't know what they were doing. Anyway, so the guy, he goes through his list of expenses for the year. And the wife had a huge list of crap she needed. She needed a car. The year before, she'd put like 500 miles on it. But still, back then it was $300 to park. It just sat in the building's garage. And they had a shindig down the block, a black tie event. She refused to walk out the front door and go the 100 yards. They needed a limo to pick him up to drive him around the block, so it showed they showed up in the limo. So then he gets to the girlfriend's house, and she's bitching at him with Blue Streak how her apartment's too small, she needs something else. And the guy just went through a horrible morning, but all he's doing is passing out money to everybody. Anyway, the bottom line was he made $1 million almost exactly and spent $1,000,001. And he's like, how the hell does anybody do that, especially me?
Well, I think it's a law of nature that demand always expands to slightly exceed supply.
There was a... I wish
I know that works. That works with storage space at my house.
Oh God, yeah. There was a study done a while ago, and I don't know. Not when people do these studies, Kevin. It seems like they really do a good job. I don't know if it was easier to find people back when people had phones. Or anyway, the dude did a study about how much money would it take. I mean, not the lottery. You know, really. Okay, Joe, you and Mary, how much would I have to give you to make things somewhat comfortable? I mean, not bazillionaire, just... And the guy picked, like, five different tranches of how much money people had, and it came down to about 20% of a year's salary in every spot. So if the guy's making 50, you know, whatever, or he and she, this is just a long time ago, if you gave him a check for 10 grand, they'd be caught up on the car payment. They'd pay off whatever little bit they had in the credit card, and they could take a week's vacation, and they'd be happy. And somebody making 200 grand, same thing. If you gave them 20%, if you gave them 40 grand, that's how far out on their skis they felt they were. And it was amazing that every level, the number was almost the same, percentage-wise. I don't know what that means psychologically, but I thought it was pretty interesting.
Well, it is also demand always expands to slightly exceed supply.
Well, yeah. I mean, well, some of it now, I think, in the inflation era we are, and this is, I don't know what, maybe you could help me with the word. It's different than the inflation that I was working with when I was at Pullman. Then the inflation was kind of right in your face. It's, when I say that, it was gasoline. Well, that kind of led the pack because of the Arab oil embargo. But, that, you know, that wasn't the general inflation level, but it was food. It was kind of everything you touched on a daily basis. Or now, it's some of that, but it's, I think it's mostly the shock that you don't know is out there. It's the air conditioner that you thought was $2,000, it's now $4,000. It's, you know,
it's the things that catch you off guard.
You know, it's the last time I got a transmission, it was $1,500. You want five? $5,000? What are you talking about? Stuff like that you never dream would be the number that it is. God help if it's a hospital bill.
In my case, when I put a new roof on the house last summer, I was like, wow. You
know, well, there was
really
a.
Now, huh? I remember when I last did it, and it wasn't nearly that.
Well, there was a group. I don't know if you guys got this in Michigan. 2 years ago, out of the blue in the Chicago area. I mean, we're not talking about we're in Colorado or Orlando. There was a nasty hailstorm out in the southwest burbs. I mean, I'm at a point where, you know, I'm talking about it was like 4 inches deep on people's decks, which, you know, you don't normally get here. But it wrecked a boatload of roofs, right? And so, where Audrey lives, a lot of people have, you know, pretty ornate internet. You know, it's not a real high expensive area, but enough to where people had cedar shake roofs and so forth. You know, and houses are, I don't know what the hell our place is. It's got to be, I mean, it's not 5,000 square feet. It's, you know, 1,800 maybe or something. It's, you know, it's just a nice ranch house. It's not nothing. So somebody down the block was getting a roof replaced, and I go, how much is that? $90,000. whoa. You had to add a zero to that, didn't you? No, it's like $90,000 to replace a cedar shake roof. And if you want, they'll lower your insurance. If you put this new roof on there, it's not cedar, but it's like $85,000. I'm going, $85,000 for a roof. Good Lord, Kevin, when we put one on my mother's house in Evergreen Park, it was $1,500, like you said.
Yeah, and you know, obnoxious. Now, I wasn't anywhere close to that, but I have a very small home, so that's part of it. Hey, two things. First of all, first million-dollar baseball player. If I said it was a pitcher in 1979, does that help you come up with a guess?
Oh, that'd be one of the New York guys. Maybe.
It was Nolan Ryan signing with Houston.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah.
And how many years?
I didn't hold up the query to see what the contract terms were. Well, let me see if I get it back here.
I remember when Billy Williams signed for the $100,000
to come. Four-year deal worth $4.5 million, so averaging 1.125.
Well, you know, Billy Williams signed the first $100,000 contract with the Cubs.
Yes, for the Cubs, yeah.
And everybody was, how much that was per time at bat, and oh my God.
Yeah, and they didn't want to give that kind of money to Bill Madlock later.
No. There's, you know, it's a, what, maybe you could explain to me, and this the football stuff, this, you know, the national championship game here. Oh, by the way, we talked last week about my weirdo observation in the pros that somehow or another there was a missive from God. Don't call any helmet-to-helmet hits during the playoffs. It just, you know, it just seemed to me that a lot of stuff that would have been called during the year wasn't being called. I can't believe that hit the goon from Miami did to the Indiana quarterback on like the eighth play of the game. Remember?
Yeah.
I mean, I'm sitting there going, for Christ's sake, the guy drew blood in hockey. It'd be a major penalty, right?
There's this weird perspective that referees and a lot of other people involved with the game and fans say, well, we don't want the referees to decide the game like that, so they let a lot more go. And it's always my contention that when you don't make a call, you're doing just as much to decide the game as when you do.
Well, I don't see how that guy wasn't tossed.
Yeah, should have been.
But it wasn't even a penalty.
They still could have done a targeting review if they wanted to. That was still an option, and they didn't do it.
And yeah, I just we talk kind of all the time. To me, it's fascinating because it's a birth of a whole new industry. When you see what's going on with the college / professional, and. I guess I'm stunned, Kevin, because I talk to you and everybody else. I think I'm keeping up, but I don't think I am. The average age of the Indiana player was 24.
Mm-hmm.
And the kid who's the quarterback on the other team, Miami. But didn't somebody ask him for the game? It's his sixth year, right?
Yeah.
And they go, what about, like, schoolers? The guy goes, what do you mean, school? I graduated 2 years ago. So what does that mean? Does he even go to school? I mean,
he probably had some kind of, you know, one independent study course or something like that that he has to take to make sure he's enrolled. But that's probably it. Actually, Carson Beck's probably not the problem, even though that remark drew a lot of attention, because he was, you know, he's already got a graduate degree too, and was a stellar student. So he's not really the academic problem in college sports, but there's just as many guys who are marginal like that, and they would give the same answer. So, you know, I don't really single out Beck for that as much as I do is it's an insightful answer based on based on what you see, just based on what you see in college in general with the amount of transfer.
Well, we know we're going down some road here. We don't know where the end is, but we're getting. I think we're closer to the point where my job is to play football. What are you guys kidding me about? If I want to go to class, I will. If I won't, I won't. I mean, what are we? We're pretty close to there.
Specifically said that an Ohio State quarterback, Cardell, I think it was Cardell Jones, that was like 10 years ago. So not a new concept necessarily, but now it's just become a mainstream concept.
Well, I mean, even the idea of a scholarship, you pay somebody $1 million, the guy can afford his own, they don't need you to give him a scholarship.
Yeah, it's just, it's that's part of what keeps it in the student-athlete, you're not an employee realm, and which is, you know, the NCAA wants to do as long as they can because they don't want to deal with all the crap that comes with being an employer on these athletes.
Well, I don't see how
for them it's just a cheap trade off.
Well, for them, I don't see how. I mean, if we're going to get pissy about this, why isn't a scholarship income?
Well, you could legitimately charge that. You could make that case. Now what? You know, I think where people don't want to do it is that there's all kinds of other scholarships, too, that are related mostly to academics, but not always, because schools bring in talent like, Northwestern and DePaul, for instance, music and theater programs. But, you know, they bring in a lot of people on scholarship who aren't necessarily stellar GPAs type of students, but they're stellar at what they do. They're brought in for their talent. So that's a different Rubicon to cross, and it will be interesting to see if it becomes that, because it's going to have to apply equally to other things besides sports.
Well, if you, again,
academic is different. I think academic is always thoroughly justified. I think need-based scholarships you can justify, but when you start giving scholarships in exchange for your services as as a provider, when I'm giving scholarships for your talent, that's a broader, not hugely broader. I think most of that applies to sports, but it does apply to other aspects of things the universities do.
Where's our what the hell is he again? An Austrian economist, Australian, Austrian. What's the difference? Boy, I tell you what,
just call them all Aussies. How's
that?
Yeah,
but he's even though I get blasted as this flaming liberal on a conservative side, on the economic side, I don't know that I'm probably more conservative than Attila the Hun. I think what you just said, schools have no business doing any of that. I mean, if you were to design it, I think schools have a product. And when people wander away from their product into all the other stuff, I don't. If you and I walk in, and not that you, that people don't have charity, they do. But if you and I walk in and see the price of hamburger, it's $4.99. Yeah, but you know, I don't do so well. I might give it to you because I like you, but the price is $4.99. I mean, if you aren't making enough and the government decides to give you a food stamp, well, that's fine. That's their job. But I don't see how it's the university's job to do all this? How much, you know, how much is the tuition? How much you got? I find that repulsive, to be honest with you. From an economic thing, not from a human thing.
Yeah.
But, I mean, I don't know if that's their job. Just saying.
Yeah, well, it always morphs very, very slowly. And then what do I say? Then suddenly you look up and you say, how the hell did we get here? Speaking of how the hell did we get here.
Well, wait a minute. Before you move off that, how is everybody 24 years old? That's, I mean, I would, if they would have said
we might,
22.
We might have the last of the COVID people in there who had the COVID year, who were like freshmen when it happened. I'd have to count backwards and see if that's it. So, you know, that guys who would be fifth year players somehow wind up with a sixth year because they got a waiver for one of the years. So you may be seeing some of that.
Yeah, but if you average 24, somebody's got to be 27.
Somebody's got to be older. We call them kickers. And a lot of them have transferred. Some of them have transferred twice. There's all kinds of things. And so when you start asking yourself why they transferred. But I think we went back and forth on this a little bit before. I don't think that's the model. I don't think that's a sustainable model to just keep being old like that and to keep bringing in your next wave of 23-year-olds to stock your team, because you're not going to hit with the percentage that Indiana did. It's not going to happen that way. And I think if you go back and you look at most of the top teams, most of the regularly highly rated teams now, they're doing a combination of the two. It's interesting to look at like Alabama's class, because they're bringing in 39 people. They are bringing in a lot of transfers, but they're also bringing in a lot of freshmen into their class. And then if you look, a lot of the transfers they're bringing in are replacing people who have left the program. So there's this there's this constant churn that they all have, where they're losing players and they're gaining players via transfer. So that's a big part of the number. So when you look at 39 for Alabama, it's more like a net. I can tell you, give me a sec, I can tell you. But it's not, the net is much lower in terms of the new people they're bringing into the program, because the departing players, transfers.
You gotta put your GPA, go in your portal application?
Well, that's an interesting question, because Notre Dame, as an example, always looked at almost exclusively at the graduate students, because you already graduated from college. They didn't have to worry about their standard transfer stuff. Now I don't have the number of people who left Alabama. I'm sorry, but if I start looking at all the other schools, you'll start seeing a whole lot of who left Alabama.
Well, do teams like the Irish? I say teams like schools like the Irish that have. Now this is a long time ago, but when you and I were there, for those that don't know or don't care, Notre Dame was on a semester system versus a quarterly system. So that meant that when we get off, we jammed a semester in. Before Christmas, got home right before Christmas, but then we didn't have to go back. I'm going to say the third
middle
week.
Of January.
Yeah, third, 18th, 19th, somewhere in there, 17th. So they get some time to play this game because their semester hasn't started yet. What if you got a quarter and you're starting January 3rd? How the hell do you get your people in time to start, if you even care about that?
Oh, I think that's a huge problem right now. I mean, think of anybody who wants to leave Miami or Indiana, if for example, any of the underclassmen. They of course want to stay with their team through the national championship. Now, if they want to go, they're late. And I know the process for late additions to a class. It's a pain in the butt. I'm sure every college is like this, where it's just a. It's a real challenge, because you start in and you come in late.
Well, can you blow off a quarter?
You might be able to if it's quarters, yeah. But most schools are in Most schools are on semesters. There are a handful that are. A few of the Big Ten schools are on quarters, and so there's some schools on the West Coast, your UCLA's and
like
so on.
UCLA's, I'll see you in March.
Well, or it might be I'll see you a little earlier than that, or it might be, you're right. It could be like that, and that, you know, that actually isn't, you know, that wouldn't be abusive. That would actually flow a little bit better because your player can get over there, get acclimated, start, go through orientation, all that kind of stuff that you like to do with new students. So that actually would work a little better than transferring from to a school that's.
So you start feeding him and all the other stuff and practice long before he's even in school. That's like going to summer school, I guess.
Yeah, a little bit. And if there's any, you know, if there's any kind of bridge things that you want all of your students to take to get in there, you know, for instance, we have a student success course that's really built into all of our degrees, and we want our students to take that right up front, and it just prepares them. Now, in our case, we have a lot of people who are not coming in prepared for college, possibly because they're older, you know, they're adult learners, and they haven't been to college in 15 years, and it's kind of changed how it's delivered. Or it might just as well be, young people who are coming out of high schools that didn't prepare them very well, depending on the locations and the schools themselves. So, you know, those kinds of things you can get out of the way. And it's not just, you know, how do you succeed as a college school in general? It's how do you succeed as a college student here? There would be some real value to that.
Well, does everybody need your guardian angel to win now? They've got Mark Cuban there. They've got the Nike guy at Oregon. And is everybody needs a guardian angel, likes to see himself on TV and keep himself being relevant and give money to people?
Well, it's interesting to see how that works, because the schools, in terms of what the schools can pay directly, they have a $20.5 million cap on what they can pay out of their athletic department. That's part of that settlement, that court settlement. And so that's what they're allowed to pay. The rest of it, there's a whole structure now for how third-party deals work, and they have a group in the NCAA who is backlogged and doesn't necessarily do a good job with this, by the way, but there's a group that has to sign off on every third-party deal now and make sure that the students are getting paid for actually doing something. They can get paid a lot of money for actually doing something, but they have to actually do something. They can't just say, you know, I'm wearing your product.
But they're playing. They're playing football.
That's part of it. Now, the problem with that is, where does a guy like Mark Cuban get involved? Well, Mark Cuban, you know, he can donate the whole $20.5 million, and that's great if he wants to, but that's not going to go a long way in the competitive world today. You know, can they come up with third-party arrangements? Can Cuban get involved in that? How does the school manage that? And what promises do they make in recruiting that they may or may not be able to get approved? That's a completely different complicator. I mean, if you look at, you know, Notre Dame only brought in 7 players via transfer, but there's 7 really, really good players, almost all underclassmen for a change. So they've gotten, you know, they've decided that, you know, they're going to play the game and they're not going to insist on grad transfers anymore. And I am sure all of those guys had a lot of offers to play for a lot of money elsewhere. So, you know, Notre Dame is doing something where it's working with its, you know, its sponsor group, which could be Under Armour, but it could be, you know, your State Farms and Gatorades and, you know, some of the things we've discussed in the past, and all kinds of other types of people who can help with promotions. So, you know, people are ponying up that way, and I doubt that they are promising the students things that they can't deliver, although they could trip up on that at any given time.
So when Notre Dame writes the left guard a check, is it the 1099 a check, or is it a W-2 check? It's got to be a 1099 check, right?
Well, that's interesting, because I have no idea how that compensation gets accounted.
Well, W-2 mean they're employed. They're probably not doing that.
Yeah, they somehow don't want to make an employee, so there's probably some other form some other stipend form of some sort that they can come up with that that they're using until at least until somebody with any sense shoots.
Well, you're
it down.
Either going to withhold or you don't. I mean, it's you're one or the other tax wise. Unless the person, if you're the second string tackle, you're Kevin O'Neill Inc. And they send the check there. That's possible, but even then you're now that's your consulting company essentially.
Yeah, right? Don't know how it works, Tom. We'd be speculating.
Well,
on
you,
that
you send somebody a check and you cover them hospitalization, and you tell them where they have to be. Sure, sounds like an employee to me.
It may sound like that, and I agree that it does because I think they're employees, and I think sooner or later. There's going to be some kind of lawsuit. It's probably going to be for injury compensation where they're going to claim that I am an employee no matter what you try to dress it up and make it look like, that I am, in fact, an employee and I'm eligible for workman's comp.
What is
as long as it takes.
Do you have any idea, going back to my conversation multi-years ago, with George Conner, we had the, what was it, Kevin, 22 surgeries after... He left football, none of them paid for by Notre Dame or the Bears. And what is the current procedure if somebody, you know, we had friends like this, you knew more of these guys than I did, but all of a sudden they're out of football for, maybe they played a little pro, maybe they didn't, they're out of football for 10 years, and all of a sudden they need a, you know, this happens a lot for linemen, you need a knuckle replaced or something. Is there any, do you go
or
back
to them? You're in constant pain, period.
Do you go back to Notre Dame? Do you go back to the, you know, the Cleveland Browns, or do you go back to high school, or are you just our insurance covers, meaning we pay for it, or collectively we pay for it?
Good question. Don't know. Next time I see somebody I know who's been in that situation, I can ask.
Well, I know George Conner, none of them was paid for by the Bears or Notre Dame, so that's a long time ago. But I know that one of the dudes, you know, I met the guy, but I used to play. Basketball at the Quonset Hut with his brother, and then, this guy was on the trading floor. We used to go skiing with him. Nice guy. But was a big family, lived right by us in St. Bernard, that's Paris. And the older brother blew himself away, right? No, not a good thing. So he ended up, for somehow or another, he'd been acting so weird for so long that they, I don't know whose idea was it, was my buddies or somebody else in the family, anyway, they sent. It's gross. They sent the brain out to where, Boston? Is that where you send the brain to find out if you got the T, was it DE or DET or something?
I have no idea where you send a brain. Keep going.
Well, but
keep going. I want to get to my subject today.
Okay. It turns out he had it. And he played, I think he played either at Rice or Evergreen Park and went to Penn. So it wasn't like he was at some Big Ten school or anything. And Penn said, well... Screw you, he probably got it in high school. No, everybody just dodged it. No, it was like nobody cared.
Well, I don't know if they didn't care or not. They might have cared deeply, but they didn't want to pay.
All right, so move onward.
Okay, move onward. Yesterday you guys talked and had a really good conversation, I thought, about, you know, corruption throughout the world of commerce. You know, a lot of it we talk about constantly in healthcare and in other areas, but really it's a broader thing where everything seems to be corrupt. And as you said, there's the acceptable level of corruption, but we're way beyond that. Now it was interesting because I had just seen a speech that J.D. Vance gave almost a year ago at the American Dynamism Summit. Okay, so this is a big innovation event.
Where's that? I've never heard of that. What is that?
I don't know where they hold it, but they hold it every year. It's a big event, and I sent you the whole, I sent you the whole speech, but I also sent you a 3-minute snippet from it, because if you listen to the whole speech, it's very much, a commercial for the Trump administration's plans. He's the vice president. He's doing his job.
Yep.
So there's that, and you can sort of see the foundations for it. So if you like to hear explanations of why they're doing some of the things they're doing, Vance lays it out pretty well, and then you can totally disagree with the conclusions. So I recommend the whole 24-minute speech, but it's the 3 minutes in. There's a 3-minute snippet that I sent separately that I think really hits home. And what Vance really gets into is he's talking about what globalism, the you can put it in quotes, you can put it in whatever you want, has done. And by that he means because we have been so intent on outsourcing labor for a long time. I mean, this goes way back to, heck, when did David Halberstam write, I read it in the 80s. He wrote a book, and I can't remember the name of the book now, but it was sort of a parallel history of Ford Motors and Nissan and how they did. And he wrote a lot about the jobs leaving the United States. In those days, it was to Mexico, but now we sent so many jobs to Asia and different Asian countries. But what he said was the thought process behind that was always that we would maintain innovation here, and we would just send the labor, that nasty pain in the ass labor thing, we would send that over to where it was the cheapest. And he said, if you follow the history of it, what you find is that where the labor goes is where the innovation goes. So it took time, but you start to find that not only is the labor taking place in China, in Malaysia, in wherever, that the labor also then you're partnered with a bunch of companies there, and they start to learn from your process. They start to learn from the process of doing it. They start to innovate. The innovation, the collaboration that they share, a lot of people, and you go to China and they'll flat out steal your intellectual property while they're at it.
They do it. They do it here. We had people from China in the office.
Yeah, I understand. And so, but the point being that slowly but surely, you have outsourced the innovation function that goes with it. And then he talked about it, and he talked about it in terms, he gave the example of the minimum wage. Minimum wage goes up, fine, you may believe in that. And he very specifically said, don't want to debate that right here. But what he did say is, minimum wage goes up, what happens? You start seeing more kiosks in McDonald's. You start seeing in fast food restaurants in general, because you have to innovate around it. So you don't want cheap labor. Cheap labor keeps you from ever doing that. It keeps you from doing a lot of your innovation domestically, but you're also outsourcing. Because remember, when we talk about innovation, we tend to think of it in terms of the new product, the new features on products, all of those kinds of things. But some of the greatest innovations in the history of the world have been process innovations. Whether you want to go back to the production line, very early in the industrial period, and you want to go back and say creating the production line, to later on getting into cellular type of manufacturing, that's a little bit different type of process. Whatever it is, a lot of those great leaps forward happen as part of process innovation, and then process innovation can also then lead you to new product innovation and a lot of the things that are going on there. Now, why do I bring that up in relationship to yesterday's discussion? Well, if you outsourced a lot of your innovation built around both products and process, what's left? What innovation is left? Well, let me see. How can I manipulate the law to squeeze a little bit more out, just like I was trying to squeeze out a little bit more on the labor side? How can I, bend the rules, if not flat out break them, to try and squeeze a little more? This is the theory that nature abhors a vacuum. And so the vacuum is now being filled by anything but innovation in many sectors of the economy. And that's, that was the parallel I wanted to draw based on, and it wasn't just based on Vance's speech. I think Vance's speech, that little 3-minute section, was an observation, and I thought a very spot on type of observation. But he's not the only one making it, clearly.
We've been talking about exactly what you're talking about on this show for 15 years now. All different sides we've come at it, to the same spot, right?
Yeah.
Now, the question is, what role government plays, not just here but other places, what makes, the U.S. so unique, and that the labor force actually got to participate for some period of time. It may be that if you and I live to be 150, We're gonna write a book together. Can you imagine that? Talking about, you know, the middle class and the labor movement was a 40-year phenomenon in one country. That was it in the whole history of the world. I mean, it looks like we might be going that way, and I sure as hell hope we aren't. But
well, I tend to think we're going the other way. We're starting to see a lot of. I mean, we are seeing manufacturing growth in over the last year. We're seeing, you know, there've been a lot of startups. There have been a whole lot of companies that have just opened additional shifts. So they didn't need to build capacity. They just needed to use their excess capacity. And you're seeing that. I heard Lutnick interviewed, and he said, and this is, you know, this would be the big hairy goal. I don't know if it's achievable, but he says by the end of the Trump administration, they want to be starting, you know, producing at a level that would achieve 40% of the chip market. You know, in the United States, that's a pretty audacious goal, to say the least. But I like that kind of thinking, and frankly, there are a lot of companies that never outsource their labor, and they've really been dedicated to, you know, applying lean principles, getting into Six Sigma. You know, Motorola is really good at that, as an example. Some really, really outstanding companies and outstanding performers, but they know that there are other places to innovate besides coming up with cheap labor. And so, you know, you'll find examples of those as we go. What's the fellow's name? Used to come on Thursdays.
Dan Janitas?
Dan Janitas, yeah. Dan used to always find, you know, he'd always talked about companies like that. And they weren't the popular names that everybody knows, but he always he always would have a report every week about a couple of companies where he visited, he met the management team, he sees what they're doing, and so on. Those are the kind of companies that I think are really positioned to succeed over the long haul, and I think you're starting to see a little bit of an awakening in some of the other companies that have outsourced either production or made their, you know, they may not be doing their own operations elsewhere, but they're certainly buying a lot of product from elsewhere. I was talking to students last night, said, how many of you work for companies that import from China, get your parts from China? And some do. And I said, any of you have troubles with those supply chains? Some do, some don't. Because some have really solid working relationships with their suppliers, and others are just saying, it's so cheap, I'm willing to accept a high defect rate when the shipping container arrives with all that stuff on it.
Yeah, except so, how do you find the ones that don't work?
Yeah, you just outsource the ones that don't work, and you might or might not be able to return them for credit. You might, you know, you're probably not, but you're just saying, well, that's just part of the cost of doing business. It's still cheaper. The problem with that is that waste is never a good thing in a process. It finds its way through the process, because what you're going to do is, if you're saying 10%, 5%, let's just say it's 5%, because that would be a high failure rate, 5% of it's crap, guess what? You're only going to catch 4.
Well, it also comes down to, what do you mean by a failure rate? That was one of the biggest issues. You know, Kevin, I was on the Y2K committee for the CBOE. Talk about a guy in the wrong spot. I don't know anything about computers. You ever feel you've been one of the, like, a board meeting or the old TV show where anybody wants to volunteer for this, step up, and everybody else steps back one, and you're standing there?
He steps back. Yeah, Three Stooges, for
yeah.
Sure.
Oh, yeah. So there was me. But I learned one hell of a lot about, and actually, Robin's brother used to do this in the fibers industry. Like, they would sell an E's and DuPont. They would have runs of various fibers that might have been, you know, clothing grade, and it turns out that it sucked for clothing. There was a mess up in the inventory. Well, they would be able to buy the stuff as seconds and stuff it in sleeping bags, and it made the best fill a sleeping bag ever had, because it was actually supposed to be clothing grade to start with, and it wasn't. But the all the chips that you'll see in, like, the CBOE, at the time, had a phone system on the floor that was the equivalent to something like a 50,000 or 60,000 person town, or more than that, maybe 100,000, the amount of phone lines. But every phone handset had some chips in them. But they were all chips that were, most of them were designed for something better. Something went wrong in the process, but they were fine for a phone. So you never knew where anything came from. But they were seconds, like you say, but they weren't waste. So there's a lot of that, too. I mean, they didn't have to throw them out. They could use them for a phone, at least. And most of the stuff is in your cars, the crummy little chips that run, like, the seats and stuff. I'll bet they're seconds for something else. Just saying. I mean
they may be useful for something, and yeah. That's fine if you can redeploy them. But, you know, again, I go back to, you know, I teach a lot of quality management, and you got to start with lean. You got to start cutting waste out of your programs, period. And waste is defined as anything that doesn't add value to the product. So if you aren't bolting something on, soldering something, welding something, if you aren't transforming, it's waste. Some waste is necessary. For instance, the forklift truck does have to go over to the inventory area and bring parts over to you. That's considered waste, but you have to transport. You know, can you limit the amount of transport that you do? Can you find ways to have to do less of it? Yes, that's leaning up your process. But there are also other, there's like this, you know, the seven wastes of lean, and I won't get into that very much, but there are a lot of things that you can just cut out of it. So if you have a process that 30% of it is adding value to the product, and you can get it to 50%, that's really good. That's a quantum improvement. And you keep going at that until you have as lean a process as you can. But from there, companies switch into Six Sigma mode. Now, Six Sigma is a concept created by Motorola dating back to the 1980s. Do you know what that means? You may have heard the term.
I have heard the term.
What does it mean? Russell probably knows what it means. Russell, you know what Six Sigma's about?
You made me run across a room and unmute myself to answer that one. You're correct 0.999999% of the time.
Yeah. Lean is built around Six Sigma is built around the idea that you have your customer specification limits. They tell you what their tolerance is, and that means on either side of your mean. Yeah, because sigmas are standard deviations, and that's a measure of variance. So what you're saying is my variance is going to be within, on either side of the mean, is that I'm going to be able to fit in six standard deviations between the customer's upper specification limit and lower, and another six standard deviations below from the mean on the lower specification limit in my variance. What that translates to is 3.4, an average of 3.4 faults per 1 million observations. That's damn near perfection. And that's, you know, there's companies out there that are achieving that now. If you imagine, you know, and I've used this example before.
You got to catch them right away, because if anything goes wrong, you're going to pump out more than three before you find it, unless you really have a system.
That's right. Is it inspections or... See, what you want to get away from is you don't want to do inspections, because that's not value added. When we go back to the lean concept, inspections are waste. They may be necessary. That doesn't mean you don't do them, but they may be waste. And especially if you are producing a lot of faulty products, you better be inspecting it, because you have to stop the bleeding somehow. You can't let them get out the door. I'm not saying you don't inspect, but what you want to be able to do is you want to be able to get your process so good that you don't have to inspect everything before it goes out the door. Instead, what you're doing is you're doing audits, periodic audits, to make sure nothing falls out of bed. Now, where do you do inspections then? That means if you look at some of the Toyota processes, for instance, every person along the production line is responsible for inspecting his or her work, and you actually put a mark on the product.
No, you don't want that. You want regulation. You want two people watching them, a couple other people writing them up, one person working.
That's the fallacy of regulation, because if I'm not responsible for my own work, somebody else is going to catch it. Guess what? Everybody has an error rate, right? Everybody has a variance. I might make mistakes, but so is the inspector going to make mistakes. So that's the faulty logic there. But yes, people do that. People think that will work. It doesn't.
Next time you go to the can, Somebody has to have the procedures for you. Somebody has to observe, and somebody has to write up how you did.
Yeah, well, you have to have standard operating procedures. You can't manage without it. Okay. But you do you do need to be able to change your standard operating procedures when you come up with a better way to do something, and then everybody follows.
Hey, well, as every man here, and Russell's, we talk about this in the what do you think of yesterday's market action, and it's kind of fleeing away from really every kind of fiat currency, where gold and silver is going to the moon. Not so much the Bitcoin. Even though I guess they're talking about that today at Davos. Yesterday was kind of an odd day, even for me. I mean, it actually was a great day for a lot of our people. We're in the metals, but that's, you know, that just happens to be, we just happen to be there. But this other stuff is the lead horses, the seven stocks aren't doing what they all ran up last year. Now they plateaued really for what, 3-4 months, Russell? They're not leading anything. I mean, I don't know where you kind of go here. And the Micron Oracle thing is one of the most fascinating things I've ever seen in the business. I mean, Oracle was, whether or not you buy the crap about, you know, Trump's kid and everything. The fact is, they got some huge deal, or were rumored to get a big deal with this the China company, which they sort of did. Stock went from like 220 to 370 or something. It looked like they were absolutely on their way. Now it's like $30 below where any of this stuff was even announced. Meanwhile, Micron, which was like $120 earlier in the year, is now $370. It goes up every single day. If you'd have bought, and again, we don't, you know, we used to have people that did pairs trades, but that's kind of going the way of the dodo bird. Pairs trades means if you follow like Exxon and Chevron, and some people used to do this. There was always companies that were kind of linked. They would say Chevron should be, Russell, you know guys that did this. You know, Chevron normally is $10 below Exxon.
Mm-hmm.
So if it got within $5, you'd buy 300 shares of one and sell 300 shares of the other. You do a.
I did this for Millennium.
Okay, but have you ever seen one? If you'd have done 100 shares,
and I did it at Ballyasny too. Now that I think about it, yeah. So
you did 100 shares.
Before you get any farther with this, because that was a transition that we didn't quite announce out of one topic.
We'll see ya.
No, what I'm saying, Kevin, is what is?
I need to go.
All right, bud. All right, you take care of yourself. Talk to you on Friday. That would be a $40,000 trade on 100 shares, Russell.
Yeah, no.
I've never seen anything like that.
I mean, I never fully understood the run up on Oracle, other than people thinking that they'd found, you know, something that might be a bit, you know, next gen technology related that was overlooked, and then they suddenly realized that the economics weren't going to be there on that one. And the Micron thing, Micron's been a great, you know, niche chip company forever, and you know, there's no reason that and I assume that's kind of what you were talking about when you were talking about the lower end chips that go into cars, etc.
Yeah,
I always felt like Micron has always made, you know, very essential parts, but they've managed to fly under the radar a bit, you know, relative to Intel or NVIDIA, et cetera. So
we were talking,
the chip thing, and again, you know, if I don't know, you know, exactly what we just lost our supply chain guy, like, you know, 45 seconds ago. But I don't really, you know, I don't know the shift to America, if that has, you know, production into the United States, if that, you know, if that weighs toward Micron or not, you know, if that's something that gives them a big benefit. If so, it's not something that I would totally, you know, be chasing.
Well, for me, you know, I try not to give any investment advice other than be careful, but you could fall into the trap. I could do it easily by saying, "Well, here's your top seven. You know, we can name those easy. We've done 100 times in this in this tech world. And oh, by the way, here's another five." I would probably just lob in there. I mean, if I was just doing this in an event, I'd say, you know, stuff like Palantir and Micron and Oracle. We obviously they're not all the same. If one of them's up 200, the other one's down 200. Well, you got to be careful there.
Yeah, and Oracle's a database company. I mean, well, I haven't fundamentally looked at Oracle in a long, long, long time, but I mean, I put Oracle more into the IBM camp than
the NVIDIA camp.
Well, Mike Rand, we do.
I mean, that's who I feel like their major competitor is. So, you know, and I haven't, you know, heard anything about IBM, you know, tripling because they had some big announcement.
They had a huge year, though.
Did they?
Oh, yeah.
Did they?
But Mike Rand is a quick story. We did this seminar for him. This is how crazy people were back in the day wanting to learn about options and stuff. We did a seminar down in these other people, and we went in Bahamas. They had like 70 people flew down to the Bahamas for the seminar for it was like 4 days. So I go down there, and, you know, we're talking, and I was talking about protective strategies and blah, 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 and I go, somehow we get on the subject of Micron. And Micron probably has gone up and down and broken dreams and made money, what, 10 times since 2000?
Yeah.
I mean, it's unbelievable. Yeah. So the stock had just gone up. It was like $90, $95 a share. I said, how many in the room own Micron? And about, you know, 30 hands go up. And I go, what's it going to take? The stock's up from, you know, $65 in 4 months or whatever it was. What's it going to take for you to roll over on a Monday morning and say, honey, it's enough? You know, and they're like, never. It's going higher. I said, okay, let's ask the question a different way. What if I told you I'd give you 110 for it right now? It's trading 95. One guy raises his hand and goes, that's why nobody trusts you crooked floor traders. You know it's worth 140. And I go, well, there's an interesting response. There was no thought that this thing was, it was absolutely the savior stock. And I'm going to say 6 months later was $6.50. I'm not predicting that this time, but I'm saying these some combination of momentum trading. I don't know if it's newsletter writers, what it is. This stuff gets crazy one way or the other, doesn't it? Does anybody look at these numbers? You know, as an economist, before we talk about other stuff that's more interesting, Kevin and I were kind of digging in because he was talking about J.D. Vance, talking about, you know, people offloading labor and so forth. I actually took a semester, might have been a whole year course, I think it was a semester at Notre Dame, on labor economics. I don't know if anybody even teaches it anymore, but they actually had books on labor economics. And it's very fascinating, the theory of it, and it you know, it could work. I don't know, has there ever really been a free market in labor where it actually would work? I mean, people can't wait to get away from the free marketplaces and the places where it's not free, where people get
yes. They have free market labor in China right now. They have free market labor in China right now, and they without unions or anything else. And this free market labor is most definitely working for the companies, etc., because they've been cutting everybody's pay. There are government workers right now that are 4 and 5 months behind on getting paid, etc. And that is your free market labor, where if people don't like that they didn't get a paycheck this month, they can go work somewhere else. It's working for business over there. It's one of their major business advantages is that it is 100% that they've got. And I don't believe there's a billion Chinese anymore. I think the demographics. I think they've been lying about that number too. But if they're, you know, if their workforce is 600 million people, you know, if they've got to find a balance where there's 600 million jobs, and, you know, let the market forces determine how many, you know, how much stuff they need done, how many people they have done, have how many people they have. If they only have 400 million jobs right now, they can cut everybody's salaries in half, which they're experiencing a lot of deflation over there because of this very topic. So, yeah. The free market labor works very well for companies. We had free market labor, you know, back in the 1800s, and some, you know, Vanderbilt University would not exist if it weren't for free market labor. Hell yeah, it works. In fact,
I wouldn't call that free market.
Well, you know, back in the 1800s or so, if you show, you know, they got a whole. Yeah, you know, they got a certain number of people that they need each day, and they got a bunch of guys standing outside the gate hoping they can work for the day. That's free market labor, man.
Well, the the idea, you did that in a lot of construction projects, but, mm-hmm. but I think the idea that every company over in China has their governmental goon there to make sure that the labor never organizes, I wouldn't exactly call that free market.
Mm-hmm.
Just saying. I mean, Pullman wasn't exactly free market when he hired the Pinkertons to shoot people.
Yeah, well, that was
a little bit of an issue.
That was a little bit of a side effect. Well, but that was just company using their ability versus labor not organizing themselves.
But there are periods of time I live on a lake now, and it's just the wildlife drives them nuts.
Oh, I thought that was Larissa.
No, Larissa's not with us today.
How's she doing? Is she okay?
Yeah, she's fine. That's just the dogs. They get excited to see the ducks in the morning.
That's their job. Let you know the ducks are out there.
The coyotes and the foxes and the geese.
Well, so if you're up here, you wouldn't be seeing any ducks.
They're letting us know somebody moved. That's all.
Up here,
an animal moved.
You wouldn't see those guys because all the ponds are frozen.
Mm-hmm.
You don't see a duck sitting out in the middle of a frozen pond.
No, our pond froze over yesterday, and they were sitting on it.
Really? Well,
yeah, they were. And the reason they were on it was because if they went to the edge of it, the coyotes were coming after them. It was a whole adventure here at the lake house.
Well, maybe they're trying to entice the coyote out in the thin ice, and they kill a coyote. They'll show them.
I don't think my ducks are that smart. So that. Now. That's what that little freak out was about. I'd probably get a dozen of them a day.
What does yesterday tell you about the market? Anything?
Just the excess volatility and the goofiness, and especially the run into the metals and the abandonment of just about anything else. I really hate people in media that do the big old victory lap, but I'm going to kind of do one because this run in metals, I'm certain, I know I've said it in other forums, but it sure felt like, my understanding was China was loading up on some of them, but it felt like buying in front of an anticipation that you're going to be involved in some sort of a conflict, et cetera. And it's been going on for 6 months or so. It just seems to be continuing. But a lot of that initial buying was large central banks and governments.
Wait a minute. The initial,
really
buying,
got us going.
Initial uh-huh. buying was us.
No, it wasn't.
No, I was a little early.
Yeah. So, but
we had
it was most definitely. And it's funny because in the portfolios that we had that are kind of associated with our kids going to school, I had gold, and Mary Beth here was like, why do we own this? Why do we own this? And, you know, it's gone now because the kids are going to school. Life's all about timing, isn't it?
Without a doubt.
I
mean, I mean, as you know, you disagree with me a lot. That's okay. But you know, I always tell the truth. And mm-hmm. we have my clients. And we have all kinds of them, right? So some people have their own stock, some people. But the people that were kind of retired, discretionary, really didn't want to pile into the high-tech stuff. Of course, they didn't want to do that a year too early, you know, so between them and us. So I said, okay, maybe when the T-bills started paying some money, a lot of people said, okay, let's put some in T-bills, and we'll put some in the metals. And I thought for a long time with the GDX, the gold miners, was kind of lagging the GLD. So we put a lot. We got, that's probably one of our biggest positions, other than individual people having boatloads of stock of one kind or another. And for 18 months, the thing never moved. We went up and down a little bit, so we made a few bucks on our put protection, and we sold a few calls against it. So we were, we were okay, but boy, you wouldn't write a letter home about it. And all of a sudden, starts to move up. And I'm going to say, we've never done this well for people as we've had in the last 90, 120 days. Now, you could pat yourself on the back, but if I was really a genius, which nobody is, by the way, I mean, I'm really good at doing matching option strategies to what people want to do. I mean, I don't know, there's so many people better at that, but that doesn't make me a genius. If I was really a genius, I would have said, let's get rid of these screwy T-bills and put it all in here, right?
Yeah, let's go all in metals.
Yeah, let's go all in metals. But by and large, I mean, literally, Russell, we waited a year for this piece of crap to go up $2. It's going up $5 a day.
Yeah.
I mean, it's insane.
I know. And it really, and that kind of irrationality makes you realize that it's people loading up for possibly an irrational reason.
Well, we're bailing in. We don't know where the dollar is going.
No, we don't know where. I mean, at this point, I think it's darn near impossible to predict anything.
Well, we have.
You know, I got a former intern texting me right now about what VIX calls should they buy because the world's going to come to an end by January 30th.
Well,
yeah. So I don't know whether to read that as it's worked its way down to everybody and it's time to take the other side or what.
Well, we're so high market wise some of these stocks that I don't know that a 2% move makes it a buying opportunity.
No, I don't. No, she said she's looking at buying VIX calls. She thinks we're getting ready to crash.
There's a lot in that argument. I sure hope it doesn't, but there's a lot in that argument.
Yeah.
You know, because you know, and you see it sort of socially as well. You see so many people. I mean, Kevin was just on, and I think in his area, in Indiana, they're doing well. They're in a distribution hub, and Indiana's in a great spot for that, and Chicago is losing some of that, and a lot of it's going either to Joliet or Indiana. Doesn't look good for Chicago, but they're picking up on it. I see more and more problems with individual people. I mean, Larissa and I talked about it last week for a long time regarding 85% of your people versus 15% of your people, to the point where I don't even know how to use the numbers to tell people whether things are good or bad. I mean, when you're selling cars at $100,000, and I do this because I just like looking for them, I can't find an old pickup for $15,000 that you can put your ass in.
No,
you know, it's somehow someplace. When you start using the gross numbers to show your GDP, and maybe you aren't as forthcoming as you ought to be, and your deflator, you can make up an economy that's going great, and it may not be. I mean, I'm not accusing people of lying. I'm saying you can do it pretty easily.
Oh yeah, no, you can do anything with number. You can do all kinds of things with numbers.
And I don't know where.
Yeah, and I you know and I know he's in the news for something different right now, but. You know, there was Don Lemon, you know, continues to try to be relevant. And a while back, he went, I think leading up to the election, he was like in Times Square interviewing people about how great the economy was. And this one guy said, well, you know, he was interviewing people about inflation, and somebody was talking about prices. And he goes, well, you know, your prices haven't gone up that much. And the guy said, my costs have gone up, you know, almost doubled over the last 4 years. And Don Lemon goes, that's not right. That's not what the government numbers say.
Yeah, well.
You know, you're telling somebody that they're wrong about their personal situation because the government number says something different.
Yeah. You know, well, that's what we're in, you know.
Yeah.
What did the guy say in the movie? Don't pee on my shoes and tell me it's raining?
Exactly. So, but I think there is an awful lot of that, and it ends up coming down to, you know, a consensus of how people feel about their personal situation.
I don't think
we have a really good survey to get on that one.
Well, you talk about the jobs and going somewhere else and innovation being other places and those kinds of things. I mean, you look at, and I'm not about to stand here and say that the Trump administration has no good ideas. I mean, I think they have a lot of ideas, so some of them I think are pretty good. But the follow-through, there doesn't seem to be any, you know, any idea of, okay, we're gonna build water treatment plants. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking about 10 years of a shit ton of work with somebody putting together a program, somebody having the foresight to do a decade's worth of work, or 8 years or 7 years. I don't see any of that. I mean, I don't see any way that the the smaller manufacturing companies, this idea that every time we're going to bring investment into this country, it's some big party with Trump there, and his people, spouting like a rooster about how they're bringing this $50 billion play. We need to not have some people being able to borrow money less than the inflation rate and other people not. If you expect the other people to be able to go out and build a manufacturer, even to support the new place. I mean, because I think it's so, we've let things kind of go to the ground, to sit there and follow the news saying, gee, looks like the Trump administration is doing this and this, and it makes sense. A lot of stuff they say makes all kinds of sense. You know what? I'm going to get my buddies Russell and Kevin and everybody. It looks to me like there's a niche here of people. What do chip companies need the most of? Could be lunches. But something where we're going to sit there and go, if that thing is actually going to go in the South Side, or it's going to go in Kenosha or go to someplace, we're going to go get some land up there. We're going to borrow money if we can, for not some gazillion dollars on our credit card, and we're going to build something next to it that we know this factory is going to need when they open. I don't see any sort of certainty at all for someone being able to do that.
One of the best early, we've all had some great mentors, and I've got one I've mentioned him in passing before on here, and the reason I mentioned him in passing on here is because he was a conscientious objector to Vietnam, and he had a PhD in mathematics. He was involved in our industry, and he was on the short list that your buddy Ted Kaczynski was on as far as could he be the Unabomber.
Really?
It's just because he matched up. It's like,
hey, careful, that guy grew up a half a mile from my house.
I know, he went to your high school.
He did.
So, that's why I bring that. But apparently when they were trying to track this person down, those were some of the, that they interviewed everybody that fell within those characteristics. So he actually did get a visit from the FBI once about, just about that. And
what'd they say? Good morning. Are you the Unabomber?
The characteristic? No, they said they were up front. They said they were investigating it, and they said, these are the characteristics that we narrowed it down to. You fall under them. It was not like showing up on TV accusatory. It was a conversation, and he knew what the conversation was going to be about ahead of time, and he had a lawyer with him ahead of time. It wasn't,
oh, really? Okay.
Yeah. I mean, they, and if you think about it, if there was somebody doing really bad stuff and they determined that they were at one of the better business schools in the Midwest and was a finance professor that came from industry, and they start to narrow it down to about 30 or 40 people, I'm not going to worry if I'm getting an interview about that, And he actually was not surprised when they reached out to him. But
what did he do? What did he do
to talk about what? Do what?
What did he do to turn them on to him? What did he do?
He had a PhD in mathematics. He was a conscientious objector, and he was of the right age.
Okay,
those were things that they thought they thought the conscientious objector thing was something that might indicate anti-government or whatever.
Ah,
so that when they were trying to figure it out, that's beyond what I was trying to talk about here. I knew I shouldn't have gone too far down that rabbit hole.
Because every time you do
it, one of the very best lessons that I learned from him was, if somebody's giving you an investment thesis that's based on what you think the government's going to do, or you're reacting because of something that the government's done, take a deep breath and do the opposite.
Well, yeah, but that's unfortunately where the big money's appearing to come from, the Saudis or the Taiwanese.
Take a deep breath and do the opposite. Hell, the Saudis were, a gigantic investor in Citigroup before the financial crisis.
Yeah.
Don't follow the big money all the time. But that was, and God knows that I have had that in the back of my mind. Between 2016 and 2020, or 2017 and 2021, and now,
as well, you know, and you got to try to work through all of that noise. But his advice on reactions to government, you know, I think I probably talked about this in April last year with the tariffs. And I didn't get too deep on the characteristics of that person, but I even said that, you know, one of the best pieces of advice I ever got was when the government, you know, makes some statements, et cetera, and it has a dramatic impact on the financial markets, give it a day or two and take the opposite side.
Well, if you start, I don't even know where to. By the way, where did the Unabomber learn how to make bombs?
I don't know. He was smart.
Yeah, well, so were we.
You went to school with him. He graduated at 16 and went to Harvard.
He went to Evergreen Park High School. I went to Marist. He went to Evergreen Park High School. I went to Marist.
Okay. Sorry.
No, but here, I do have a question about that. In my era, we didn't even take. I mean, Evergreen Park was a nice school. I used to go in the summertime and take a gym and stuff there, and I took typing there and all kinds of crap. But I went to Marist. But it was a nice community school. They didn't even have calculus when I graduated from Marist. How could this kid at age 16 be a genius in calculus at Evergreen Park? I don't even think they had a calculus class.
Well, I doubt he took calculus before he went off. The silly example, but you know, I watched the show Young Sheldon.
Yeah.
The progression is, you know, the high school can't teach him anything anymore, so they send him to a local college, and it reaches a point where the local he's like 12 or 13, and the local college, the two professors that work with him go, we don't need to understand what this kid's doing anymore. And that's my assumption with people like that, is that, you know, if either of my daughters had been, you know, like that, you know, I probably would, you know, if all of a sudden they're at 16 and you know, high school's not challenging for them anymore, then, you know, you step on to the next thing.
But then what do you do?
I guess.
Well,
and then what do you do with it? Then I guess you go crazy. Although, you know, I'm going to brag on my freshman daughter. She's at Purdue, and she showed up for class. You know, semester started last week. Showed up in class, and someone sat down next to her who looked really young, and she started talking. And the girl, it turns out the girl's 17, finished high school, you know, a year and a half early, and was starting in engineering at Purdue. And Emmy was like, oh my gosh, you definitely, and she just started like in January, and Emmy's like, here's my phone number. I know, you know, this has got to be overwhelming. Like, turned on the matron thing very quickly, which I just very proud of her.
She's a 19-year-old mom. I love it.
Yeah, my 19-year-old mom with a 17-year-old daughter.
Well, but one of the ladies
that you just gotta love, you know, your teenage daughter having an empathy like that.
Well, God, yeah.
Yeah, it's just, it makes me very proud.
One of the ladies we've had on the show a couple times years ago, she's retired now. She was the head of admissions in one of the engineering schools in the Big Ten, and we'll go nameless. And I said, do you have anybody in there young? And she goes, oh, yeah. They're like 16, 17. And I go, what do they do all day? She goes, they don't do anything except study. They're nerds. But they're here, and they're brilliant.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a crazy world. But I'm concerned of what these tariffs are doing. I don't know, when you start wrecking things that aren't perfect, be it NATO or whatever, you got to be careful where you land. I mean, I mean, we're kind of wrecking the old vestige of college football, and we're not sure where it's going. You know, I mean, we may land better, it may land worse, but we're doing the same thing.
You guys had to have jumped on the Carson Beck. I haven't been to class in 2 years. Thing.
Yeah.
I haven't seen clarification on that, but I just wonder if when he said, you know, I graduated. And how that he is in some online classes.
Well, Kevin said that he actually graduated. He's got a grad degree. He's not. If you're going to pin that on somebody, he made the comment, but he's not the poster child of that.
Well, in Memphis's quarterback a while back, his final year of eligibility, he was a PhD student.
And if you're and I know this, if you're a PhD student, you can be a full-time PhD student and just be working on your dissertation. I don't think we're going to have a Dr. Carson Beck in our future, but you know, it is possible to be, you know, enrolled and actually not going to the classroom. But needless to say, I felt kind of sick at my stomach when he said that, because Miami is a great school.
They're big in engineering, aren't they?
They're an excellent school. They do well in business as well. They are, you know, you have to have a certain classification to be a Big Ten school. Miami and Florida are the only two, the only two schools with strong football teams in Florida that would qualify to be in the Big Ten. I think Florida, if I were going to do one last big expansion of the Big Ten, Miami would be like the number one school I'd be going after.
So you'd have to fly from Washington to Miami to play a soccer game.
Oh, I was just thinking how great a UCLA Miami Big Ten football game would be.
God, you know, we're going to go two ways on this, and I don't know, or some combination thereof. I think that if somebody is actually in school and is percolating along on a PhD program or whatever.
No, I don't. I think there's more to the I'm not going to go. Because, you know, Joe Burrow, who I think he's an LSU guy.
Yeah.
Somebody asked him if he was going to miss school, and he said, I never set foot in a classroom. He took all of his classes online.
Well,
their school is set up for that.
Well, there's going to be the two ends of the spectrum are the guy like you goes to school. He's playing ball. He likes playing ball. He goes to law school or business school or whatever, and he's there for 7 years. Why can't he play? I mean, that's one. I think it's going to end up to be where he can play, and he's going to say, "I'm making, you know, $500,000 a year. I'm going to law school. I come out of here an attorney. I've saved up a bunch of dough. By the way, I've played between high school and here. I paid 11 years of football. That's plenty. I have no desire to go to the pros, even if I did get drafted, and I'm happy. It's plenty of ball. I don't want to, you know, knock myself out anymore." That's a model. Then you're going to go the other way, where I'm here to play football. What's the school thing? You know, and it could be at any age, freshman, sophomore, or whatever, where you go to a different school every year. And I don't even know how the hell you keep track if you're transferring back and forth from a place with a quarter to the semester. And I mean, are you ever in class? Where the hell are you? I mean,
beyond that, I mean, they don't let you transfer all your credits every time you transfer.
I think they must be doing, you know, some of that.
I don't really know the programs that people that are going that really are kind of targeted for the NFL. I don't really know what kind of degrees that they're working on, et cetera. But I assume they're kind of doing the bare minimum, and likely are not, you know, not leaving school with a degree.
But the percentages, I know everybody has a view of the world. Everybody on the trading floor, runners or whatever, I want to be a trader, which, you know, that's fine. But even to these guys, you know, young, dumb, and full of whatever, they have to realize that, well, how many people a year go to the NFL? 200 get drafted. Now, a few other guys sign, and a lot of the people drafted get cut. So it's what? It's seven rounds times 30 teams, right? So it's 210 or something. So, I mean, I would guess that neither one of us is a professional coach, but I bet if we watched two Indiana practices, just the two of us schmucks sitting on the sideline, we're going to say those two people stand out. They're possible being in the NFL.
Yeah.
My cousin who played the star here in high school, and then he went on a ride to the University of Colorado. It's a long, long time ago. And he said, it was at his 91st birthday. He goes, Tom, why don't these people understand the parents? He goes, the parents, if you're not all state, which means out of all the high school players, how many people are all state? 1% of them, if that. If you're not all state and you go to some college, if you're not All-American, I mean, every time you move up the thing, it's like walking up a step in a pyramid. It gets smaller and smaller and smaller. He goes, you know, I was pretty good, in college. I was real fast. Then he had to do a couple years in the military. He said, I came back. I went out for his Canadian team. And he goes, I lost a step. He goes, it doesn't seem like much. But he's not that big. He goes, the guy I just got around, I just didn't get around, and the guy kicks my ass. He goes, I knew I wasn't going any further. I played a year Canadian ball, and I said, there's no way I'm going to the NFL. I knew. He goes, nobody had to tell me.
Uh-huh.
He goes, but if you're not All-State, All-American, Dr. J and I went out. We watched Northwestern play Minnesota when Pete was on the team. We had a break here pretty soon. But, we see this guy walk by, this big black kid, impressive looking. And John looks at him and he goes, there's a pro tackle. Just by the way the guy walked, the light on his feet. We watched him. John goes, watch this guy block this guy. Northwestern had a horse bleep team. His name was Chris Hinton or something. He ended up being a worst round pick and had a big pro career. You could just tell when the guy walked by. He was a cut above the rest of the dudes. I mean, right? I mean, you and I walk by, they go, those two guys, what are they doing with shoulder pads on, right?
They shouldn't even be on that field.
Yeah, they should. Well, we'd be like the guy with in the commercial with the stop sign. Mm-hmm. The State Farm commercial. Who is that guy? Anyway, SP Futures down 10. Surprised we're not up here this morning a little bit. NASDAQ Futures down 76. Come back, we're going to talk some markets.
Listen, are you a 50-year-old person looking for term life insurance? Then you need to talk to Bob. Bob specializes in helping people find $1 million or more of term life insurance for a couple of $100 a month. Look, you need to know there's a price war in the term life insurance business, and you may be paying too much. Call Bob, and he'll shop and see how much money he can save you. Look, this could be the last term life insurance policy you ever have. Your rates are guaranteed for the next 20 years. That's right, guaranteed level rates for the next 20 years. And if you're a smoker or your health is not perfect, Bob has great rates for you too. So for $1 million of term life insurance coverage for a couple of $100 a month, call Bob right now. 800-989-1415. 800-989-1415. 800-989-1415. That's 800-989-1415. Paid for by Term Direct.
Stocks, jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here. Right now.
Low North Bank Stocks and Jacks. I'm Tom Howell. Andrew on the board. SP Futures down 8. NASA Futures down 64. I thought maybe we'd get a little bit of at least a dead cat bounce here this morning, but not so far. Dow down 151. Individual stocks. United Airlines is up almost 4%. Well, they are up 3.4%. $3.77. They had earnings last night. So a lot of people are upgrading their seats, so they're making dough on that. So 1%ers are carrying the day, United Airlines, which is, somebody's got to do it. Over in Europe, DAX down 339, 1.4%. Ouch. FTSE only down 13, however, 0.1%. CAC around only down 44.5 only. European stocks extend losses. Trade war fears send jitters through markets. There you go. Asia. Nikkei down 216.4%. Hang Seng up 97.4%. Shanghai up 3, call that flat. So a little bit of movement there. Bonds, the 10-year rate. I got to remember to ask Russell this. What he sees is the split between the 10-year and the 30-year separating out here. As this morning, 10 years, same spot, 4.29. The Bund, 2.87. Japan, 2.28. So Japan's sort of catching up with the Bund, which is odd. Oil up 45 cents, 60.81. Brent up 42 cents, 65.34. And here's the number. The natural gas is up 83 cents, 4.75. That means obviously it's cold. RBOB up a penny, 184. Gold, and here's been the action. Gold's up another $106, 48.72. Silver always going the other way a little bit, down 35 cents, 94.28. Copper up 3 cents, 584. Problem is, there's no real ETF. There's a couple ETFs for copper. Well, there's a copper miners, and there's another one. They don't trade that much. The copper contract at the Chicago Mercantile Exchange is 25,000 pounds. So it's a serious, you got to be a serious guy to be doing that. Foreign exchange, A dollar is up a little bit, but still the euro is over 117, 117.3. British pound, 134.25. So actually the euro is up versus the pound here a little bit. Crypto, which kind of got whacked yesterday, down 871, 88, 680 today, so down again today. Andrew, what do you got for us, Traffic, Weather, Sports? Weather sucks, and it's going to get worse.
Yeah, it's not very good there, and starting off with sports, not very much there. Just a little bit of basketball. The Bulls won over the Clippers yesterday, 138-110. But yeah, over Chicago weather, it is currently 29 degrees. We're going to have a high of 31 today. Our morning's going to be very cloudy, very breezy. We're going to have a lot of slippery road conditions. Throughout the afternoon, it's going to be a little bit of sun in there, but just going to go right back to snow tonight, about an inch we're expecting. Over in Phoenix, they are currently at 47 degrees. They're going to have a high of 70, and they're going to have sunny skies throughout most of the day with some clouds in the evening. Finally, for Chicago traffic, things have already built. I had noted down the traffic numbers here like 10 minutes ago, and everything's already risen a pretty good amount here. On the inbound Kennedy from Montrose to the Jane Byrne, it's going to take you 37 minutes. Inbound Edens from Lake Cook is going to take you 56 minutes. Eisenhower from Wolf is going to take you 53. Dan Ryan from 95th is going to take you 34 minutes. And the Stevenson from I-294 is going to take you 42 minutes. That is all I got. Back to you.
Russell, I don't know if you heard, but I'm going to awake tonight. Eddie Joyce, I mean, he died.
Yeah, I heard Ed Joyce's pat. Can you text me the details?
I will. It's at the funeral or wake tonight, funeral tomorrow morning. And yeah, you're in Indiana, so.
Yeah, I
am. One of the nicest guys.
I was lucky enough to work while he was still at SIBO back in the day. And just can't think of a negative thing to say about the guy.
Without a doubt.
You know what I mean? Just a super, super guy.
You know, his brother was like the number two guy in the fire department.
He was the chief,
but he was the number one guy, yeah. I remember going to his wake. He's got to be long
sorry, time. So here's the funny thing about that one, and this is just such a freaking Chicago thing. You know, when you're the junior most person at the Options Institute, you got to do a lot of tours. And we come down the escalator, and there's a capacity sign. And every once in a while, you know, somebody would be kind of a smartass and go, how do you guys know that there's not more than that number of people on the floor? And I said, well, you know, I guess we could stop and make everybody stand still. I said, the only people that would really care is the fire department here in Chicago. It might be a fire code violation. And the fire chief is our number two's brother. So I think we're okay.
Yeah, that would do it.
Yeah, so chief... I don't think Chief Joy, and I said, and if they're going to come over and count people, we probably going to get a heads up.
Well, it was a good thing there was it was decent weather at the brother's wake, because there was a line about two blocks down, and it was a very popular guy, nice guy.
Oh, yeah. No, but I mean, yeah, just a...
Hey, Russell.
I did want to say one thing with respect to United.
Okay.
The Ozempic thing apparently is helping tremendously with airlines' fuel costs.
Really?
Yeah. Like, across the industry, it might save $1 billion in fuel costs.
So what about the part when you get off it, you gain weight back four times faster than you get off a regular diet?
Well, when everybody starts gaining the weight back, we're going to short them airlines. But I'm going to do a little digging on there on you know, did their profit margins, because there's no way on earth they're going to say that.
No. But well, they say a lot of people are up.
I just, when you said United in great numbers, I'm like, oh, zipping.
Well, the add-ons, the people getting the better seats.
Mm-hmm.
This is January, and since you are a market genius, I have to pick your brain a little bit and help with my clients. You know, I've always kind of resisted picking individual stocks for people. I like doing sectors or the market, because that's essentially what I traded in the OEX, which doesn't mean we don't have all kinds of stocks from people that brought it in here, and we manage those. But, you know, we're up to, we use, and this is not a push for these guys, but normally we stick with the sector spiders, the spiders that add up to the real spiders, SPY, the SP 500. There used to be like eight of these things. Now we're up to like 11. that are chunks of the.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a million ETFs, but we use the ones that we can do option hedging against. I didn't even know there were a couple of these new ones here. Do you like any of these? XLCs, the communication services, XLY, consumer. We haven't done any of this stuff. Consumer staples, we don't have anybody in there. XLE, we got a lot of people in. That's the energy piece. XLF, there's people in. XLV is one of our biggest positions. People want to be in the healthcare. You know, it doesn't mean like these are the right places to be or anything. It's just, where our people want to land. Industrials, the XLI. Materials is XLB. Real estate, this is a new one. XLR, we've done nothing in there. XLK, technology, I think we might have a few people in there. XLU, utilities. Is there, if you were going to say, do you like any of these?
The industrial space.
You like the XLI?
And the reason, and here's the reason. I coach a CFA team or CFA challenge team, and we are having to analyze a company that makes a lot of the components if you're building a distribution center or a manufacturing center, and there's just a lot. They're having a heck of a time with keeping up with everything that they need to ship out right now. So everybody talks about. How we're going to make money in AI, et cetera. They got to build out these massive centers for the power generation plus the computing in the AI centers, and the people that build those things out. I feel like there's still opportunities there, and if anything, those kind of companies might hold up better if we get a market sell off relative to the. So they benefit from the AI thing. They're not in a bubble like most of the AI stocks and or the AI related stocks, and they're diversified enough that if they if AI manufacturing suddenly goes away, there are going to be other things, especially with stuff continuing to possibly come back to the U.S.
Well, I think some of the Defense Department would be in here too, right?
Yeah, and I was actually thinking staples a little bit. You know, if we do end up in a major conflict, that the demand for those types of things may go up.
Well, the top holdings are GE, Caterpillar, RTX. Who's RTX?
Raytheon.
Okay, well, that's defense. Boeing.
Yeah.
And GE Vernova, whoever that is. Uber Technologies, Honeywell, which is defense. Union Pacific, Eaton, and Deere.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not so sure to put the Union Pacific in there, but they are.
Yeah. Well, but I'm saying maybe Buffett wanted it in there, so they put it in there.
Yeah, I mean, this is it's a pretty solid group of stocks.
He's BNSF. Sorry, I got the wrong one. But yeah, those are companies that you would expect to hold up fairly well if we do get. Some sort of a market sell-off, but I also think there's some fundamentals that would help. They're going to help that sector out. So if I had to be somewhere, that's where I would be. I'll tell you, I'm still formulating this one, but one of the big academic arguments in the world is that small-cap stocks give you better returns with extra risk over time. We haven't seen any prolonged small cap outperformance in maybe two decades.
Well,
since the inception of the Russell 2000, which is, I think is like 1980, and again, I'm doing a lot of these numbers off the top of my head, so you can't hold me to them perfectly, but the concept is there. The S&P 500 actually... has now long time outperformed the Russell 2000 since the launch of the Russell 2000. And I think the reason behind this goes along with some things that you were saying earlier about smaller companies not having the ability to be innovative and compete with larger companies. And then I think that's part of it. I think another part of it is this huge emergence of private equity and venture capital. I think a lot of companies that would go public as a small cap and help the Russell 2000 performance benefit from private money and don't go public until they're going to be a large cap. Like, I think there's SpaceX is one. Is OpenAI going to, one of the AI companies is going to go public. There's like four or five large cap companies that'll probably be in the S&P 500 within a year or two. going public this year. That's not the kind of companies that we used to have go public. So I'm not, you were asking where would you invest? On the opposite side of it, I'm having a hell of a time ever seeing small cap stocks outperform, you know, again like they have in the past.
Well, I'll do us a favor.
And I think it's a structural change.
I think a lot of that has to do, our two guys that are kind of on this big time is most, Hal and Carl. I'm going to say that they would probably make a very strong argument, and it's not, you know, 100% of the argument or anything, but over the last 20 years, the cost of financing has spread dramatically.
It's everything. Yeah.
That's what I was talking about earlier. I don't see somebody being able to gain so much on what Trump is trying to do. And I'll give him a break and say he's trying to do the best to bring manufacturing back here. I just think that the books are so cooked against anybody small and medium.
It's got to be large companies that do it. Which, it really does.
They're not as nimble. And a small company, if they are any good, one of the big guys buys them and puts them out of business or something.
Well, and that the like Google, if anybody's got really cool emerging technology, Google's gonna buy it.
Yeah.
I mean, that's why their name is Alphabet, because they bought so many small companies. They're really just a consortium of a lot of smaller technology companies.
Well, NVIDIA just bought somebody.
They're practically a public VC firm.
Yeah.
And I believe that, you know, you've been talking about the Magnificent Seven stocks. I think of them, Google is really the only one that had a really gigantic banger 2025.
Yeah, probably.
I think I when it, like you said, they kind of tailed off. They had great performance, and then in the last 3-4 months, they kind of tailed off. But I think Google is the one that really has continued to just be a ridiculous performer.
But we have to have. Well, there's a lot of things we need to do as a country.
Yeah.
Boy, I don't know where we'd start, but I mean, NVIDIA just bought some. Intended to buy, I don't think it's closed yet, some company 3 weeks ago for $20 billion. What did those guys do? Are they buying them to do something with them? Are they buying them because they're going to, you know, essentially steal a technology? Are they buying them to put them out of business because they're a competitor? I mean, do we even ask these questions?
No, but that's, I mean, those are all, you know, it typically, my impression has been that the reason that Google buys some of the firms that they buy, that they do so just to kind of block their technology.
Oh, well, and Microsoft has to be over 35 or 40 years. I mean, how many people they put out?
Put out of business.
Well, I'm saying, there's no more WordPerfect, is there? There's no more in Google. What was it? There's no more MapQuest, right?
There's no more Lotus 1-2-3, which was the spreadsheet I used in college. No, I know. Yeah.
So what are you telling everybody? Telling everybody how young you are? I use 14 column paper.
No, I was the very. It was a new class. It was the first undergrad class that used spreadsheets at Memphis State in
really?
The business school, and it was my last semester. And I was a little bit more computer savvy than people, and I ended up almost being a teaching assistant in the class.
Oh,
so yeah, what, it was one of the few classes I did very well in.
So what would it say about me?
I was a terrible student, dude. I there's just no other way to put it.
I was always fortunate enough to be able to take courses that I liked.
Yeah, I think that was part of it.
And, you know, I had some terrific teachers all along the way, and I didn't mind, if somebody young is watching or listening, you know what? If you go to class, take notes. The guy tells you what you're supposed to know. And most of these guys are pretty good. You go through the stuff they tell you that night, the night before the test, you study. So you've touched everything 3 times.
Yeah.
And it's not that big of a deal. I had plenty of time to play basketball and go to the bars. I mean, you know, if you do, but if you cut off one of the three, then you got a problem. You don't know what the University of Chicago used to absolutely bury people because they would give you this huge thing. They only had a few class ed textbooks. I don't know what you guys do now, but it was all papers written by economists. It, you know, you'd be at this huge manila envelope with a, you know, 8 inches thick, and they would tell you all these things you're supposed to read. Well, you'd go to class, you'd go to class, and the guy would be very articulate about what you're supposed to know and follow a thing, and you'd read the ones that you're supposed to. You take the test. This was no big deal. Other people would read all of this stuff. They go, well, that wasn't on the test. The guy goes, I never talked about it. I found it. There were a couple of classes that were way over my head. When you start with some of the really high-end statistical stuff, I don't know what I was doing in there. The worst one I ever took was integer something-something and network flows. Integer modeling and network flows. You know what that is?
It's basically kind of like trying to model out how very difficult things move in motion, I believe.
But it has to do with, you know, if you do a linear program and then advance on there is quadratic programming. Well, then linear program, you do quadratic programming, everything, your answers can be in decimals, right? But if you're doing integer programming, you can't show up with half a pilot. It's scheduling and things like that where everybody has to be.
How many people do you have to?
Everybody always come out, and it's very difficult to do. And actually, the one thing that they had just thought they were, they finally had the computer power to sort of solve one of the thing, the most unsolvable things in all of math was known as the salesman coloring problem. You know what that is?
No, I do not.
If we say, hey, Russell, we're going to hire you as our next guy to sell jerseys and stuff to 25 high schools in Michigan. We want you to go out the next couple of days to go see all these high schools and introduce yourself. To try and find the route that gives you the least amount of mileage and time.
Oh, I see.
The logistic
thing.
It is well nigh impossible until somebody did something where you'd go to a place and pivot back to the other place. I'm looking at this thing. I had no idea what they were doing. It was so far above my pay grade, Russell. I was like, what am I even doing here? But
do you know what you do now? You put all the variables into Excel and you run something called Solver.
Really?
And it just answers it for you.
If you ever had the misfortune of know anybody who uses Excel, but then when they go to add up the column, they pull out a calculator, would you immediately not want to talk to that guy ever again?
So you just don't trust Excel, do you?
I don't know how to use it.
Oh, you know. That's fantastic.
It's much neater than my writing on the 14-color paper. I still want to add it up.
And you're falling farther behind because if you embark upon the CFA program now, you're going to have to learn Python.
What is that?
It's a scripting. It's the language that's behind an awful lot of the stuff that you're looking at on your screen right now.
But you know, in some ways, though,
but it's a pretty simple language to use, and you can incorporate it in Excel pretty easily. But it's what I use for my PhD.
But where do you get the sense when you're talking to your students to where you look at an option and you can look at the implied volatility, you look at the VIX, where you look at the stock or the index and you say, wow, that's expensive or that's cheap. I mean, where do you get the judgment?
Because I don't want to lose credibility with them. I'm usually using like the Shiller PE or something along those lines that's got a really long time frame as well. You know, we're overpriced, but we can be overpriced for a long period of time. You know, that kind of stuff.
How come a long time ago, back in the 2000 crash, somehow I stumbled, and I don't know how I got there, Russell. When I look at these stocks that are growing fast and I think might be overvalued, along the line I stopped using PE and I started using revenue per share. Is it just me or has that worked its way in?
What's really worked its way in is cash flow per share.
That was kind of always there, yeah.
Yeah, cash flow. Well, it's become much, much bigger deal. And actually, I think we can thank Mr. Buffett for that.
Okay.
Because that's his big deal.
By the way, there's a headline today that his new guy in wants to dump Kraft Heinz.
They've already been trying to do that.
That's not totally new. Because, you know, you don't know, but the last book that I'm writing is on every time Buffett sold stock. And so, and I've already been working on Kraft Heinz, so I know that they've been exiting it.
You know, we got a dash, but you know what? The lady asked him what his worst purchase ever was.
What was it?
You'll never guess.
No, what was it?
Berkshire Hathaway.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, yeah. He held on to it too long.
He said it was a business that just wasn't going anywhere.
Yeah, he sentimentality. I've got a whole chapter on that.
Really?
His sentimentality around it. He admits, I mean, it's like every year you can almost feel him taking a deep breath as he said, and margins continue to contract at Berkshire Hathaway, blah, blah, blah. And then when they finally did away with the textile part of Berkshire Hathaway, you know, he admitted that he hung on to it too long, but it was a sentimentality thing, et cetera, and which is one of those behavioral finance things that gets in there and results in suboptimal performance.
I'm going to ask you, before we dash here, we see, boy, I don't want to make this, but I will, you see people hire people that refuse to say that it's a dog hire. You see people maybe even vote for people, not this time, but every time. They refuse to think it's a dog vote because the person didn't turn out. They try to prop people up. I'm going to say that the Berkshire Hathaway thing, a lot of it was just ego. he just didn't want to say, God, this was a bleep up, you know.
Yeah, and he was, you know, this is many years ago.
Oh, yeah, this is so, 40 years ago.
You know, this is when he was a younger man and might have been, you know, less willing to admit a mistake, you know. I think I actually thought you were going to say McDonald's because they bought McDonald's, owned it for 3 quarters, sold it, and then the stock just took off.
Oh, really? Yeah, I
didn't. Yeah, and a lot of people don't know he even owned it. And you, if anything, if you look at McDonald's, you're like, you know, that is kind of the kind of company that Buffett would own.
We would think, with all the real estate and everything else.
Yeah. So there.
Anyway, bud, thank you very much. Good stuff. You're down in Indiana.
I hope we get
to talk to
next to my lovely bride.
Good for you.
New place.
And you got the house down the block here.
Yeah. Yeah, we're in both spots.
Well, good for you. Say hello to the two daughters and the dogs.
I will.
You're not dog sitting anymore, are you?
No. Don't have to do that. Right. So, we still got the one that we got originally who was supposed to live 6 months, and she's on 5 years now.
What happened to the blind guy you were watching once in a while?
Oh, the blind guy. I think the dog, the people who had the dog, their kid played football for Minnesota, and I think he graduated.
Okay.
But that's when we would keep that dog.
All right.
So,
well, have a nice weekend. I hate it when it's 25 degrees and they say a cold front is on the way.
That's just very discouraging. Luckily, it's going to be about 40 here.
SP futures up 8, NASDAQ futures up 2. We just went from down to up here in the last second. I'll be back tomorrow. I'll tell everybody all about it.